Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin Icicle Willis.
That's right. We're finally frozen in the Great White North.
Oh my goodness. It's been cold here. I went to California. That's why the show's late. I guess I should apologize to the audience because everybody's really excited to hear from my guest, David Marler. Yay, who's awesome.
He's in the top, maybe two. He might be my favorite guest that I've ever had.
Yeah, he's great. So he, of course, wrote the book on UFO triangles, or triangle-shaped UFOs, which is a great book, well-researched, loved it. Oh, this is kind of cool, too. You know how we're having Jacques Vallée at the conference?
Yep.
I guess he read Marler's book. And wrote him a note saying, hey, great book, great job on this. So that's huge. But, he's been doing some research on a mass sighting in Farmington, New Mexico. That's really cool. He asked us about a photograph we had in Wendell's files for that, and I sent it to him, and he's done some research on that photograph too. So we're going to be talking about that and a lot of his recent research on this amazing case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be great. That's the one that happened in New Mexico in the 70s, am I thinking right?
1950, I think it was. Yeah.
50s. Uh-huh.
So a long time ago. So that's really exciting. So this is going to be a great show. So I was delayed because I took a day off to go, and this weekend I drove out to California because I'm going to go to Denver this weekend, but I'm not going to be able to see my sister who lives in California, so I decided let's just drive out there and go see her. So I came back, and it was cold out there. The temperatures were just frigid out there, just like they are out here. It's getting into the upper 40s here, and that's just so cold.
Yeah, that's the way it's been here all along, and now it's in the 20s, so I feel your pain in a more drastic way.
Yeah, and then some. So I was being overly dramatic, because for us it is my thick California or Colorado blood is gone. I'm a complete wuss now, and this 40-degree stuff is just really cold to me. Plus, we just don't own coats, or we don't want to wear them, so that's our other problem out here. So,
yeah. So we should call you Alejandro Traveling Man Rojas.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you're on the road. You're going to Denver.
Well, it's the holidays, so I'm going to Denver this weekend to see the rest of my family, so that'll be fun.
Right.
And my girlfriend's birthday is later this week. So for her birthday, I'm taking her to Casa Bonita.
Oh, yes. I've been there many times years ago.
You
That's
have?
A fun place. Yes.
Oh,
fun
my gosh.
Restaurant. What a great restaurant that is.
I love taking people there because it's just silly. It's weird. It's like no place else. It's hard to describe. It was featured on an episode of South Park. And I just feel that she and her daughter have to experience Casa Bonita.
And I was there, and I hate to say this, but I was there all the way back in the 70s the first time.
Wow. It's a long time ago.
Been there a long time, that place.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I will be traveling, and that's what's going down. And so an exciting show today. Very happy you could join us. You're definitely experiencing real cold out there with 20s. Holy crud, that is freezing, literally.
And the power went out earlier today. I'm just hoping it doesn't happen again.
Okay, so we better move on then. The news.
That's right. Yeah.
So you're here to talk with me about some UFO news, and we always let you start off, so why don't you go ahead?
Well, I want to talk about an interesting video. Now, this didn't happen this year, but it was recently reported on, and it was written by Roger Marsh again. And this is a video over Utah. And UFOs move like a school of fish.
Oh,
now, I don't know
one.
If you had a chance to look at the video, and I do suggest to the listener to check it out. It's really strange objects. They're kind of grouped together. And at first you think they're like, you know, maybe dust particles or something just flying overhead, or the way they kind of stick together. But it's really hard to figure out. The person that took the video does a pretty good job narrating as he's going along. And he's never suggesting that they're UFOs. He just wants to know if someone out there can, you know, give him an idea what they are. And I'd be interested to find out who has looked at this. This happened back on May 15th, 2014. Again, it's just recently been posted up on openminds.tv.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, did you have – the one person I'd like to look at this video and give an opinion is Ben Hansen, because he does all that nighttime vision. I wondered, do you know anything if he's taken a look at this yet?
I don't think so. I know they've been busy for the holidays. We should ask him to look at it, though, and see what he thinks. There has been some debate online about the video. One of the hard parts is this person says he's a photographer and a videographer. He's got a BS in film, and the Utah State Director, Erica Lukes, talks about, you know, in this case, he's a very intelligent, well-spoken person. And in the video, you can hear that. He is an intelligent, mm-hmm. well-spoken person. Seems very grounded. However, the difficulty with the video comes in that he says in order to, you know, we've talked about this before, in order to capture the light, there are a lot of still images that are strung together. So the actual speed of the objects is difficult to make out. He says the objects were moving too fast to be birds. However, the videos, the speed of the objects in the video isn't real time. So they do seem to be going quickly, but he says, you know, it's kind of a stop motion thing. So that doesn't represent the actual speed of the birds or the object. So it could be a bunch of birds, you know. So all we have is his testimony in that they were moving unlike or too fast to be birds. So otherwise, yeah, I think it is some interesting video.
He also says, you know, this is an Ogden Utah, and you know, if anyone lives there, to go out, they come out about like 10 o'clock, I think he says, something like that, every night he sees them. And by golly, I just so happen to have a really close friend that lives in that town. So I'm going to ask him, and I'm not just making this up, I'm actually going to ask him to go out at night around that time and just see if he sees anything. I don't know if he wants to, if he has plenty of time to do that type of stuff. But anyway, I'm going to ask him anyway, see what he says.
Yeah.
No, you think that's a bad idea?
No, go for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You didn't sound too enthusiastic.
No, I'm still just deep in thought about the video.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't understand that part of it that you're saying. I know that he did say, you know, this was sped up here and there, but I didn't realize that the entire film was faster motion.
Yeah, so that's the hard part, because it was like, you know, so, yeah. So people, that's one of the aspects people are debating in the video. So I difficult see. To see. So, and which is nice. I kind of like that. In the Open Mind UFO group on Facebook, we have some skeptics or some people who look closely at this stuff. So,
yeah,
which is good to have a hard look. Another interesting video is one from Montana. Now, this was taken at 9:15 a.m. on December 12, 2015. It's a daytime sighting where you see several bright objects in the sky moving around. They're moving pretty slowly. And the witness says, you can't see this in the video, I don't think, but the witness says that they looked like parachutes. The video is only about 25 seconds. I don't know if they are parachutes. It could have been people being dropped in parachutes, but he just felt that they weren't, though, that they were moving westward, so they just weren't people dropping in parachutes. And what you see are, like, you know, five or six kind of bright objects in the sky in the daylight sky. So interesting. He submitted a few photos with his video. So that's another interesting case. I think, did I mention this is in Montana, Billings, Montana?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You know, they are moving along. I did look at this kind of fast if they'd be like people. You know, my first thing, I know he says there's no like trails or anything. My first thing would be to say daylight flares, but you really don't see any bright lights or anything. They're just plain white. It's kind of an mm-hmm. oddball. But, you know, I mean, my first thought was, oh, it sounds like he's describing flares, but I don't know.
Yeah, especially at night. And I guess it's possible. I don't know that they do daytime flares. But it's certainly possible. But yeah, they're just very, I guess they could be debris. They could be a grouping of balloons. I think totally possible. I don't see the shape, the parachute shape that he says he sees, but even when I zoom in, but of course the witness is going to be able to see that more clearly. So I guess it could be. It doesn't look like parachuters. Many people have said, you know, it's not like shaped like people parachuting. But
he actually looked in binoculars.
Yeah, that's true.
And he said that they had fire colors.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
What the heck?
And you're right. It could be balloons. That's, you know, I mean, it sort of does look a little bit like a grouping of balloons, not really clustered together, but
mm-hmm.
maybe tied together or something.
Yeah.
Very possible.
But interesting videos. Yeah, a couple of really mm-hmm. interesting videos, both of those from Roger Marsh, you know, who submitted those. They were MUFON sightings and videos. Of course, he puts those together and posts them on Open Minds for us, which we're very happy about. So everybody can check that out.
Right.
That's the news. Not a whole lot of news. Now, there was a sighting. I guess we can mention it. I haven't written this up yet and probably won't because the holiday is so busy. Dang it. But, in fact, we're planning on doing a UFO report today, but I don't think we're going to get to that because it's just so busy this week and with the holidays. We'll have to do that next week. But my point is that there is a story out there about a guy from Montana, Dr. O'Connor, who took a photo. And I saw this photograph. I actually got a preview of it. And it does look really interesting. Looks like a silver saucer. But Mark D'Antonio burst my bubble.
Oh, yes, I saw this too. It was a water droplet.
It
yes.
looks like it's a water droplet. And how
yeah.
can you tell if it's a water droplet on the window? Because I'm like, you know, sure, it's shaped like that, but how do you know? Telltale sign. He's got it in the bag here, I think. The reflection is on the opposite side of the object. So the sun is on the right. The reflection mm-hmm. of the sun is on the left. And that's a phenomenon that happens in water droplets, is that the refraction of the light inside the droplet makes the opposite end of where the light source is be the brighter spot. So I think that kind of nails it for me, that I think Mark's probably right. I don't know if this concept has been expressed to Dr. O'Connor, who has thus far dismissed some of the other ideas of what it might be. I haven't seen him address the water droplet thing, so I'm going to do my best actually to shoot him an email and see what he thinks about that. But I don't know. I kind of think maybe Mark's got that one. What do you think, since you took a look?
Yeah, well, I believe this did get some mainstream media already.
It's been getting a lot.
Yes. I can't remember where I saw that it was published, but it's a major paper or
well,
or
it was,
news company.
It wasn't a major one at first. It was something like, I think it was one of the UK tabloids, or it was a local paper. Actually, we posted it. I posted the link on our daily headlines thing. Maybe it was. It probably was a local paper that did it. But then the UK people picked it up, and now everybody's got it. It's all over
yeah.
the place. So USA Today.
That's what it
mentioned
is.
It. Everybody
That's
mentioned
what I'm talking
it.
About now. Yeah, someone's got to get to this guy
yeah.
and let him know. It's kind of a bummer, but
yeah.
it seems like he was, you know, trying to be real careful. But, you know, I mean, that's why it's really good to have someone around like Mark, someone
I know.
That has seen things like this before.
I wouldn't have known. The image looks shocking when you first see it.
It does.
Wow, flying disc, yep. This is awesome. You know, you're going over in your mind, what could this be? What could this be? This seems foolproof. Mark, I finally got the one here. And then that guy pulls this water droplet thing out, and it's like,
you know, I've talked to Mark before. Some people call him, you know, a plane debunker, and he's not a debunker. He's helping
the
field by figuring out what these things are. Mm-hmm. Just another thing you can check off the list. So I don't consider him a debunker at all.
I don't want to be going to Seth Shostak and being like, look at this. Ha ha. We finally have it. And him looking at it and saying, that is a water droplet. We know this. Here's why.
Way.
okay. And then I look like an idiot. So, you know, we want to be as careful as possible.
That's right. Yeah.
All
and
right.
Speaking of that, great guest coming up who is very careful as possible.
Who's great guest?
Your guest coming up, Dave Marler. I mean, he's always very cautious in his research.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I consider him a great guest.
Yeah, me too. That's what's great. Yeah, we'll talk to him, and he talks about, you know, all of this searching for the details and sources, which is great. Yeah, he's wonderful. So I guess we'll move on to that. Thanks again for joining us, Martin.
You bet. All right. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you next year.
Yes. All right.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk to David Marler. I am very happy to welcome back to the show David Marler. Hello, David.
Alejandro, good to speak with you again.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. So, of course, you wrote this magnificent book about Triangular UFOs, and now you've been researching this this sighting from 1950. If people can hear the rustling, because this is the I've got that front page article from the Farmington Daily Times that you gave me on this case right here in my hands, actually, to look at it and reference some of the cool stuff on here. So maybe just tell us about this case. When did it happen, and what was reported back then?
Well, it actually was an event that transpired over three consecutive days, and that's something I think we need to say at the very beginning, because if you look at references in some of the UFO literature over the years, both through official sources and within the UFO community itself, sometimes it's erroneously alluded to as a one-day event that occurred on Friday, March 17th, 1950. In point of fact, it actually occurred over 3 days, Wednesday, March 15th, Thursday, March 16th, and the big day was, in fact, Friday, March 17th. And then subsequent to those events, we had the Farmington Daily Times paper that you're holding dated March 18th that chronicled essentially 3 days' worth of reports. Now, what makes this case unique, and which is why, after all of these years, I'm reinvestigating it, well, a couple of reasons, but first off, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of eyewitnesses to this event. Now, that's the first thing we need to take into account. Secondly, we have what would be defined as multiple witness, with a capital M, when you have that many witnesses, but we also have multiple objects that were observed, and estimates range anywhere from 50 to 60 to hundreds of unidentified flying objects, UFOs, flying saucers, of course, was a term popular back then, but unidentified objects flying individually and flying in formation. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important point to take into account. The interviews I've done with some of the living eyewitnesses, that was the one thing they emphasized, was not so much the objects themselves, but the fact that when they moved, they maintained formation. And so we have this, and I think one other thing we need to add, these were broad daylight sightings. We're not talking ambiguous lights in the sky, as you and I are quite familiar with many of these UFO reports. These were structured objects in formation, estimated upwards of hundreds, seen by hundreds, if not thousands of witnesses. And that's the traditional story, if you will. But as I delve into this, by the way, I'd like to mention at the forefront of our discussion, UNM Library, University of New Mexico Library here in Albuquerque, was very instrumental in directly helping me with uncovering some of these old newspaper articles.
How cool.
I gave my first lecture here to the local New Mexico UFO group about 2 weeks ago, and I had Mr. Mike Kelly, director of the Southwest Special Collections Group, and he personally assisted me in going through the microfilm, and he was captivated by this. Now, he's a historian, as you can appreciate, and he said, I never heard of this before. And I said, well, Mike, you and a lot of other people haven't heard of this. And I think that's one more reason to reinvestigate or, you know, reinstill curiosity on the part of the general public, because whatever occurred in March 1950 over Farmington was a significant event. But as the information unfolded that I gathered, and I have in my presentation, what occurred over Farmington was the tip of the iceberg. We had sightings in Las Vegas, New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Tucson Ferry, New Mexico, Eunice, New Mexico, and believe it or not, Alejandro, it even transcends the New Mexico border. We had sightings in Colorado. We had sightings in Texas, all the way down, believe it or not, into Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And this all transpired within the month of March, 1950.
Yeah, pretty incredible. And, I mean, what I knew about this case, first it was a 1950s case. I remember just the picture of the V formation of what appears to be lights at night. And that's about all I knew. I thought I knew it was an event where there were multiple witnesses. But like you said, you know, most of what you've said just now is news to me, which is interesting. So I guess my first question would be, did you run across this case when you were writing your book on the triangular formations and you found this one particularly interesting, or what made you want to delve into this case?
No, that's a great question. Actually, it goes back quite a few years, several years, in fact. When I was the Illinois MUFON state director, when I was living near St. Louis, Missouri, several years ago, this would have been around, say, roughly 2000 timeframe, I was working with my state section directors, and one of my state section directors by the name of Mike Driscoll, he lives in upstate Illinois, continually, almost every conversation, if we were talking about a UFO case or a UFO subject, inevitably Mike would always make the statement, I don't care what you're saying. Nothing beats that Farmington case from March 1950. He always brought it up, and it was always in the back of my mind. I mean, multiple conversations with Mike over the years. And so when I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico in March of 2012, I had begun writing my book on the triangular UFOs. But when I first moved out here, I thought to myself in the back of my mind, you know, I'd really like to go up to Farmington and see what I could find out, or at least do a little bit of digging, since now it was, you know, very close to where I lived. It was you know, very economical trip that I could make up to Farmington to try to gather information. And so once I concluded writing my book on the triangular UFO phenomenon, I wanted to investigate this on a personal level. I didn't think it would develop into the project that it has. And, in fact, this is the first time I'm publicly acknowledging this. I'm actually starting to work on a book to chronicle all this information. I gave that recent lecture I mentioned, and it was an hour and a half long, and I was just touching on the subject matter. There was so much more to discuss, but I didn't want to make my audience comatose after an hour and a half. I figured they had enough information for one day.
And so people know, you did a talk recently for New Mexico MUFON in Albuquerque. Is that correct on this topic?
Correct. Yes.
That's funny.
And very, very well received. It was very well received. I was happy to see that. You know, a lot of people want to hear new information or new cases. Well, sometimes we have old cases that have new information. And as I mentioned to the audience, we have to look at these cases, these UFO cases, as I like to say, take a practical approach to a conventional approach to an unconventional subject. And I reference the fact that this is no different, our investigation of Farmington, than a criminal case. If new information comes to light, we need to reopen that case, reexamine it. And that's what I'm trying to do, trying to add a little bit more depth and a little bit more breadth to the investigation. And as I mentioned earlier to you, there's a lot of new information that's come to light.
Right. I would imagine that Mike knew this as a UFO sighting with multiple witnesses. You've probably discovered that this is, it sounds like that, this is even a better case than he had originally thought.
It is, and you have the famous newspaper article there in front of you that I provided. And for the most part, if you do an internet search today and you look up the Farmington, New Mexico incident from 1950, inevitably almost every posting, blog, reference, whatever, will reference the information contained in that newspaper article. And really, that is the historical document, if you will. That everything quotes that newspaper article. But I've actually delved into the microfilm. I've uncovered additional newspaper articles from the time period, you know, contemporary to the sighting. And not only in New Mexico, but again, as I mentioned earlier, Colorado, Texas, that shed light on the Farmington case, but also alludes to other cases that were going on at the time involving multiple objects in broad daylight. And I think that we can't overemphasize that point. We're not talking mm-hmm. ambiguous light from the sky.
So going over the timeline, getting into the case,
absolutely.
At least with, and we'll talk about the other cases as well, but at least this Farmington incident that took place over the 3 days, how did it start?
Well, at the risk of doing information overload, I actually put together a composite timeline based on the original Farmington Times newspaper article, but again, in addition to additional newspapers I uncovered, and I might also add declassified documents out of Project Blue Book, which at that time would have been Project Grudge. Mm-hmm. But real quick, if you like, I can do a very quick bullet point run through as far as what transpired.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, just starting off, we can certainly dissect this afterwards. The first day, Wednesday, March 15th, at 11 a.m., between 11 a.m. to 12 noon, was the first wave of sightings over Farmington. And according to the reports, between 6 to 20 objects were seen in broad daylight moving east to west. Now, the 15th was a rather slow day. And I like to say it was almost like tremors building up to the big earthquake. Mm-hmm. On the second day, March 16th, again in the morning, between 10 to 10:30, the first wave of objects were seen. And they didn't allude to how many, but just numerous objects were seen in the sky. Then at 11 a.m., a half hour later, 11 a.m. to 11:05, the second wave of UFOs were seen over Farmington by multiple witnesses, and they estimated about 15 objects were sighted. So this was the prelude of things to come. Now,
Description of those objects at all?
No specific description other than they, mm-hmm. some alluded to the fact that they were reflective objects, but not much detail. And mm-hmm. I might add, because we're dealing with different sighting groups, and especially when we get into March 17th, some of the objects were estimated to be low altitude, whereas other objects were estimated to be high altitude, anywhere upwards of 20,000 feet. So we have varying objects of varying altitude going in different directions. And just to kind of really add some color to this, on Friday, March 17th, the early morning hours in the Farmington paper, it referenced a solitary saucer-shaped object being witnessed. Then at 9:15 a.m., and again, this is kind of correlating all this information, at 9:15 a.m. in Tucumcari, which is over near the Texas border on the other side of the state, this is over on the east side of the state, in Tucumcari, there was a flyover of a solitary object witnessed by two workers that were working on a drainage ditch. At 9:15, the same time in Farmington, from 9:15 to 9:25, 5 to 9 saucers were observed. They departed to the northeast with others that were reported 45 minutes later west of town. Then at 10 a.m., hundreds of objects were seen west of town. At 10:30 a.m., a red object was observed, and we'll come back to that because that's something that keeps popping up again and again in these reports. At 10:30, also in another part of town, two revolving discs were seen in the southeast, and the witness was quoted as saying they appear to be, quote, having a tussle in the sky, unquote. Hmm. Some other witnesses alluded to it as a dogfight, which we'll see here momentarily. At the same time, other witnesses reported seeing revolving discs that were swooping and swerving and turning like tops. 10:35, three objects were seen staging a dogfight in the sky, as it was alluded to by the witnesses. At 11 o'clock, two metallic UFOs were seen. A smaller UFO was moving very fast south to north, and a larger one was hovering stationary. So as we'll get into this, the official explanations that were being tossed about was that this was just debris blowing in the wind. Well, if that's the case, how can you have a solitary stationary object and you have a fast-moving object seen in the same portion of the sky at the same altitude? 11:15 to 11:30, there was reportedly swarms of hundreds of objects observed, and a red object was noticed amongst the silvery gray or white objects. So again, one solitary red object being reported. This flotilla of UFOs departed to the northeast based on the eyewitness accounts. At 2 o'clock, a silvery object shaped like a rectangle with rounded ends was seen moving in a westerly direction over Farmington. At 3 o'clock, quote, fleet of hundreds, unquote, flying in formation from northeast heading southwest was seen over downtown Farmington. At 3 o'clock, and this is from a declassified document from Project Grudge, the same day, 3 o'clock, as the fleet of hundreds of objects were flying over Farmington, we had a group of air crewmen working on the tarmac at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. They saw three objects that appeared to be tumbling and spinning, moving over the Sandia Mountains, and they disappeared to the north-northeast. Now, later in the afternoon, possibly around the same time as the sighting at Kirtland, one of the other newspapers alluded to the fact that there were sightings in Las Vegas, New Mexico, which is north of Albuquerque, considerably north of Albuquerque, and there was a flyover of multiple objects there. Later in the afternoon, again, we had the sighting of Tucum Ferry at 9:15. The editor of the local paper stated, on record in the newspapers from the time, that there was a flyover of multiple flying saucers, and one red object was noted to be different from the others as they moved over Tucum Ferry. Now, that's just what happened in New Mexico, so we can focus on that right now if you like and dissect it, but there was a lot going on elsewhere in the Southwest as well on those same dates. But that is a Reader's Digest version, if you will, of what occurred over Farmington and other parts of New Mexico.
So it's pretty amazing, all of these sightings. So did it become, of course, this Farmington Daily News article came out. Did that get a lot of traction? Did it become a media event?
It did in one respect. As you can appreciate, it hit the newswire, and a lot of other newspapers at the time picked up the story. And that's why I referenced earlier that really the sole historical document or the primary historical document was that original article. I have Lubbock, Texas newspapers that picked up the story, as well as other parts of the country that basically ran that same article verbatim in their newspapers. But it's interesting. Despite the media coverage at the time, and this is one thing that really just, I'm almost embarrassed to state, the UFO community at the time and in the decades that followed barely touched this. There were certainly some researchers, which we can talk about. Lauren Gross, famous UFO historian, he wrote this up in his monographs, UFOs, A History. And then Dr. James McDonald, years later, delved into this, and that's a whole other aspect of my investigation that I pursued.
Mm-hmm. So one funny thing about this article, before we move away from the paper here, was that this letter, there's a story here, newsman writes letter to flying saucer pilot.
Yes. A rather humorous story compared to what was being reported over Farmington.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I really haven't focused too much on it. It's very interesting, though, to see that there was a little bit of a lighthearted nature regarding the subject, and I think that's an important part to bring up, because despite all of these sightings, no one really was in a panic, and that kind of flies in the face of what we think the government military at the time was concerned about. If we acknowledge the reality of this, it's going to cause mass panic. To my knowledge, and in speaking with two of the witnesses that are still alive and hearing the interviews, recorded interviews from witnesses previously, there was no panic. No one was in fear. There was only one instance where a woman was crying, and that is in reference to a new witness that I uncovered with the help of Scott Ramsey, I might add, the Aztec crash researcher. He was able to put me in touch with one of the last living witnesses, who, ironically enough, was able to attend my lecture 2 weeks ago here in Albuquerque. So
how cool.
The audience not only got a chance to ask me questions, but we had a living eyewitness from 1950 that they could speak with.
That's awesome. So then, when one of the people who investigated, like you said, UFO investigators didn't get too into it, interestingly enough. Although I can kind of see it in that the Air Force was doing investigations, and a lot of the civilian investigative organizations were an answer to the Air Force closing their investigations, and especially early on in 1950. I mean, this was just a few months after the Air Force started doing investigations. I guess two things. One is that, you know, especially the Area 51 guys, the engineers out there like to think that the U-2 was the reason why, you know, there were so many UFO sightings back in the early 50s. But this certainly predates the U-2. So what did the Air Force think? What did you find in those Air Force records? Were there only a few of these incidents that they were investigating, or were they investigating this whole wave?
Well, let's take a step back for a moment, because before I actually, in my lecture recently, before I discussed Farmington, I had to set the stage for the audience. Mm-hmm. Of course, as you're mentioning, it was in the early stages of the Air Force investigation. This was during Project Grudge, and as Captain Edward J. Repelt in his famous book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, alluded to the fact that Project Grudge was kind of the dark ages of the Air Force investigation, because there was a lot of skepticism at the time. There was a lot of anti-UFO propaganda being thrown out to the general public at that time. But concurrent with that, we did have, as I'm sure you recall, Project Twinkle that was going on right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. We had the famous, world-famous meteorite expert, Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, who taught and headed up the Department of Meteoritics here at Albuquerque at UNM. And he was contracted by the United States Air Force to investigate the green fireballs that were being seen at night traversing the skies over New Mexico and other parts of the Southwest. And so that started in November 48 and continued into mid-1951. So beyond all of this occurring in March 1950 with daylight sightings, it was right in the middle of this green fireball wave that was being investigated by the military. And but to your question, what's interesting, even though I do have documents that allude to sightings such as the one we discussed at Kirtland Air Force Base on March 17th, 1950, if you look at the official tally of UFO sightings, and this is something I shared with my audience recently, you look at March 1950, and they have a chronological listing of official, and I think that's the key word here, official UFO reports that they conducted that month. There is absolutely no reference to Farmington, New Mexico whatsoever. In fact, there's no reference to New Mexico other than a sighting over Holloman Air Force Base that occurred on March 11th. So isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. You have reports of hundreds of objects over 3 days reported by at least hundreds, if not thousands, of eyewitnesses, and there's not even a line entry for this event in the official tally.
Hmm. And that is like the official list of Blue Book cases, because, of course, the Blue Book cases encompass the Grudge and Project Sign cases.
Correct. This would have been Project Grudge. I usually use the umbrella term Project Blue Book, because, like you said, it all kind of is under that umbrella term.
Yeah.
But this was Project Grudge reports, and those are declassified. People can go online and take a look at that for themselves. But what's intriguing, Alejandro, is I wanted to dig a little deeper, and that's where I found the SPOT intelligence report. It's an Air Force OSI SPOT intelligence report, just a separate memo that's in the files that discusses the fact that they interviewed at least 2 to 3 witnesses regarding a March 16th, 1950 daylight sighting by eyewitnesses in Farmington. And they described solid objects maneuvering and turning sharply in different directions, and that would accelerate at high rates of speed.
Wow. So that's really weird. So they don't have it listed in the cases, but they do have some files on it.
Exactly. So either the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, or there's something a little bit more nefarious going on here.
Mm-hmm. So what conclusions were they reaching? Like you said, you know, Project Grudge, Ruppelt talks about how that, you know, typically project names are chosen randomly. However, he suspects that Grudge was not because
I think that was intentional.
Yeah, they seem to – Air Force had a grudge against the whole UFO topic since, you know, the last Project Sign concluded that UFOs were a real phenomena, and people got upset about that conclusion. So now they wanted to
absolutely
debunk them.
The famous estimate of the situation, you know, that Dewey Fournay and Edward Rappelt and all these others had witnessed and had read. But yeah, this was almost like a reaction to that report. So, like I said, there was a high level of skepticism. Now, I think it's important, in going through the declassified documents, I also found this, another SPOT intelligence report. This one dated April 19th, 1950. And this was declassified back in 1975. But it was a SPOT intelligence report, again, Air Force Office of Special Investigation. The subject title was Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. Now, as you know, having gone through a lot of these old declassified documents, they're not going to tell you the secrets of the universe. They're not going to tell you what's hidden in this hangar or that hangar. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there's a cryptic line or sentence that really makes you raise an eyebrow. And in this particular case, we have a synopsis on this SPOT intelligence report that states, unidentified aerial objects were observed over Los Alamos and Sandia Base, which is Sandia here right in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on February 25th, March 4th, March 22nd, and April 1st. Objects were of the general type of those previously observed in the New Mexico area during the daytime.
Huh.
And that's a very important part, because what this is alluding to are the green fireballs that were being observed. It was part of the Project Twinkle files. And, okay, green fireballs are one thing, and they're listing, and I think it's important to note, look at all of these sightings that they had cataloged in New Mexico in 1950. Again, isn't it interesting it doesn't show up on that tally sheet of official investigation? But when they stated, you know, that these were described of the general type of those previously observed in the New Mexico area during the daytime, what could they be alluding to? In my opinion, they're alluding to the Farmington sightings that occurred right in the middle of that time frame, between February 25th, the first report that they have listed there, and April 1st. Mm-hmm. Farmington was right in the middle of that time period. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an indirect reference in the government's files to the Farmington incident.
I think that makes sense, and it makes perfect sense that they would be aware of the Farmington sightings, especially because it was in the paper. And Project Twinkle was a big deal. I mean, there was a lot of attention being put on Project Twinkle. Lincoln
Absolutely.
La Paz, incidentally, who you referred to, had mm-hmm. his own UFO sighting, which yep. was a big deal in Life magazine when it was written about, mm-hmm. Posted there. And he believed there was, you know, something more mysterious to this whole phenomena. So you're right. It would make sense that they would certainly be aware of a newspaper article or several of them about a wave of sightings.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is another newspaper article I came across, and I'd never seen reference to this before. Dr. Lincoln La Paz, as you mentioned, was a very serious, objective researcher. He was not prone to jump to conclusions. He was going to weigh the evidence and then make his decision. Initially, he thought these were simply fireballs, meteors. But due to the luminosity and the frequency and the fact that they were plotting trajectories of these things and not finding any debris or evidence of an impact or a meteorite, he really began to, you know, as many scientists do when they start exploring this phenomenon, starting to come away with the realization that this cannot be summarily dismissed. And mm-hmm. I came across, going through the old microfilm and newspaper archives, a Farmington Daily Times article, interestingly enough. The one you have there with the famous story is dated March 18th. This is Saturday, March 25th. And the title of the article is Quite Serious. Farmington saucers. And the article, the very short article, describes Dr. Lincoln La Paz and his investigation and his position at UNM here in Albuquerque. But it states at the end of the article, he said in his opinion, the reported sightings of a mass flight of saucers or strange objects over Farmington recently belongs in the, quote, quite serious, unquote, class.
Wow.
So we have an official statement by Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, who is heading up Project Twinkle's investigation of the fireball, that after speaking with eyewitnesses and getting details regarding the Farmington incident, that in his scientific opinion, this was a quite serious case.
Wow, that's a really cool find. Now, what about those Grudge files? I mean, I get pleasantly surprised looking at Project Blue Book files occasionally when I see a serious investigation that ends up with where they're, you know, they express genuine mystery as to the nature of the sightings. However, you know, you get a lot of, especially during the Grudge period, where they just very gloss it over, and they obviously aren't paying much attention or doing a very good investigation. Was it the latter that you found?
Well, if you like, we can talk about the official explanation, what the government's official statement was regarding this, because this is intriguing, and this is something. There's a lot of disinformation that we're looking at when we review these old files and we look at the government's explanations. And at the time, compared to today with the Internet, we didn't have readily accessible information to where we could try to either, you know, support their decision or refute it. And in this particular case, let's talk about what their official explanation was. And then I think I do a pretty good job of systematically just tearing it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Mr. Mike Kelly from UNM, he actually came up with a great title for this part of my presentation. He goes, so Dave, basically this portion of your presentation is debunking the debunkers. I said, I like that, Mike.
Yeah,
I said, I think I'm going to use that. So, but when you look at the official explanation, and this gets into Dr. James McDonald as well. We can talk about him afterwards. But the official explanation that was put forth is that a Skyhook Navy research balloon was launched from White Sands, where I was earlier today, ironically enough, and it was launched. It ascended to an altitude of approximately 60,000 feet, where due to the cold temperatures and pressure, it ruptured. And what the people in Farmington saw, and by the way, the official explanation insinuates it only occurred on March 17th, and for the listeners out there that are envisioning their calendar, March 17th, they also made a point of emphasizing, happened to be St. Patrick's Day. So I think we can read the subtext, what they were trying to imply.
Right.
A lot of people were drinking, and they saw flying saucers. The subtext, I think, jumps out as far as what they were trying to emphasize there. But anyway, so supposedly the Skyhook balloon ruptured and people saw little bits of plastic floating down and blowing in the wind. And that's what people, that's what explained the flying saucers that people saw.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the official explanation. But as we've already established, there were sightings on two previous days. And again, not just over Farmington. So looking at that though, of course, this theory was put forth by Donald Menzel, who we all know is kind of a debunker from the 1950s. He, you know, quite possibly had intelligence ties, according to Stan Friedman and a few others. He, of course, wrote a couple books debunking the flying saucers. In fact, in the Blue Book report, they even have a quote from his book, The World of Flying Saucers, where he describes this explanation for the Farmington incident, again, making it sound as though it was a one-day affair. But again, it doesn't account for the two previous days. And I think this is an important point. Dr. James McDonald, famous UFO researcher, tried to follow up on this explanation. And he contacted several people with the Office of Naval Research. And I recently went to the University of Arizona at Tucson and reviewed all of his file notes on this case. And that's where I got a lot of new information that has never really seen the light of day. And I have his research notes, his handwritten notes, where he states he contacted a man by the name of Dombrowski at the Office of Naval Research. He checked the records. No record of any balloon launch occurred at Holloman Air Force Base, as stated by Dr. Donald Menzel.
Mm-hmm.
And again, isn't it interesting that Menzel alludes to this as being a one-day affair on that Friday, but we already have that Air Force Spot Intelligence report that alludes to sightings, you know, a day or two before.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of holes in this explanation. And then we also can look at the wind data for that day, and I do an exhaustive analysis looking at the wind flow for those days at these various sighting locations. And in many cases, we have objects moving counter to the wind flow. In fact, one of the eyewitnesses, who I can mention publicly, has given me the okay to use his name, Mr. Marlowe Webb, who is still alive. He's 91 years old, and he is a successful businessman that still lives in Farmington, New Mexico. I've interviewed him several times. The site of his, the location of his sighting was this Perry Smoke Chevrolet garage. And as he relays the story, he was inside working, and he noticed a number of individuals, some of whom he recognized from the city, that were out standing near the gas pumps. And they're looking up in the sky, and they're pointing. So being a curious young man, he walked outside and looked in the direction that they were pointing and looking up. And sure enough, he saw, I believe he estimated 15 to 20 objects. He couldn't discern shape, but he said it was a distinct difference to the background, and he remembers that they were moving in formation, some type of formation, and as they turned, they moved together. And in that particular case, he stated it was moving in a linear fashion across the sky until he lost sight of it. And that was observed on the first day, Wednesday, March 15th, between 11 a.m. and 12 noon. And again, getting back to the wind, the UFOs flew east to west in a straight line fashion as far as he could ascertain before he lost sight of it. But the climactic weather data for that time period indicates that the wind was essentially almost blowing in the opposite direction. The wind was actually out of the northwest, yet these objects were moving to the west at that time. So again, we have modern day information that we can look back on and correlate to see that whatever these things were, they weren't bits of debris or leaves blowing in the wind, as some people alluded to. Mm-hmm. And then we can look at the third day. The second day, we don't have detail as far as directional data, so we really can't correlate it. But we have objects that are moving, making acute right angle turns, and the weather data indicate that there was no discernible wind at the time. So whatever these things were, they were apparently under some type of powered flight. That's the only conclusion that we can come to.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think it shows that Menzel didn't do a very thorough investigation. He was essentially just probably going off the newspaper article and trying to explain it away.
Absolutely. And in fact, you'll appreciate this, Alejandro, and I think your audience will as well. I have copies of the handwritten notes from Dr. James McDonald's files. And I have a notation that's dated January 28, 1968. And it states, phoned Dombrowski from hotel in D.C. He said he checked all ONR, Office of Naval Research, records, and he has no underline, Skyhook flight anywhere in the country on March 15th or March 18th.
Wow.
And then he goes on to note, nearest flight in time was released from Minnesota and terminated over Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So it really puts a damper on the explanation that this was a Skyhook balloon if there were no flights even up in the air at that time.
Yeah, that theory is just completely blown out of the water, or blown out of the sky, actually.
Well, or you might say we deflated that argument.
Right. We could probably come up with a few other puns. But photos, I know there's at least – I think there's at least one photo out there. I haven't, caught up with you to talk more about that. Are there more photos, or is there just the one?
Well, there
or is there
more
even
than one.
Mm-hmm.
There is a famous photo, and I haven't had a chance to really talk to you. We kind of alluded to this in email, but I want to publicly thank you and Open Minds for posting the story that you did back on October 11, 2013, where you put forth the photo that you discovered in the Wendell Stevens collection. And I think you may even post this with the segment here. But for those that haven't seen it, it basically shows a V or echelon formation of some type of structured circular objects. And there are five prominent ones in the picture. But in the background, you also note smaller, possibly higher altitude circular objects as well. And this is a photo that's been extremely mysterious. I've done a lot of UFO research over the years, and this one, as I've told several of my friends and colleagues, has really been so difficult to try to research. I've found new information out about it. I've been able to establish a little bit more background, which we can talk about, but as you'll see, there's still a lot of mystery surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
So first off, let me just add that in addition to you posting that story, which really rekindled interest in this case, that's why I want to thank you, and for newer audiences, for younger audiences that may not have heard of this account or this case before, it really sparked a lot of people's curiosity, so thank you for that. But I would notice that I had seen that photo somewhere before in the UFO literature, but not very often. I've gone through my extensive files and library here, and I've got a lot of material for the researchers that have been here. They know. And there's very few references to that photo anywhere in the literature. And, of course, you and I know, and your audience, we've seen the Lubbock Lights photos ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. We've seen some of the other photos, the Salem, Massachusetts photos, et cetera, many, many times, the Trinidad, McMinnville photos. These photos were not widely publicized.
And that's why I'm really curious to find out what you found, because I don't even know if they really are from Farmington at that time. I know that's what the note says on the photograph. And
exactly.
I had seen it before, reference to it. So it seemed like a good case, a good photo. I have
to admit, it intrigued me because I had never heard of that photo being directly tied to Farmington until you found that copy in Wendell Stevens' collection.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really fueled my personal curiosity with regard to it. Now, I might add that in July of this year, I was able to obtain a 1950 original Newswire service 8x10 glossy photograph of that same photo.
Mm-hmm.
However, the photo that Wendell Stevens had was a cropped photo. The 8x10 that I have, and I'll be happy to share that with you, Alejandro, it shows much more in the background. It shows much more to the left, to the right, above and below that formation of objects. In addition, it has a lot more clarity. It doesn't have too much contrast, whereas when you compare it to the copy that Wendell had, his has a lot of contrast, and I think you lose a little bit of detail.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, the photo that was in the Wendell Stevens collection, you were very nice enough, when I requested it, to send me the copy of not only the front but the back of the photo. I did some contrast enhancement, and I noticed that on the back it actually states that the photo has imprinted on the photo paper, this paper manufactured by Kodak, and I did some research. That wasn't commonly used on their photo stock until the 1970s and into the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you have there, or what Wendell had, was a reprint of an older photo.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's interesting. I compared my uncropped photo to the photo that you had. And then one of the rare instances where I did see this photo alluded to in the UFO literature was the French researcher Amy Michel, his book from 1956, The Truth About Flying Saucers. In that book, he has the photo. And it states, the caption, "Another American photograph of flying saucers." Now, contrast to that, all the other photos he has in the book, he references location, date, time, details regarding the photo. This one, all he alluded to was another American photograph of flying saucers, and nowhere in the text does he elaborate on the photo, the history, who took the photo, etc. So I think even for Amy Michel in 1956, it was somewhat of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed, and I did a side-by-side comparison, I took the photo that you uncovered from the Wendell Stevens collection, put it side-by-side with the one that Amy Michel had in his book, and there's a small white photo blemish at about 7 o'clock position from the main object in that photo. It looks like it's some type of emulsion, or maybe just a some type of defect on the photo. It's very prominent, very white. It doesn't look like it was an original part of the photo. And I noticed that the copy that Wendell had the same photo blemish in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
But the original 8x10 glossy that I have did not have it, which tells me that was not on the original negative. And long story short, what I've come to the conclusion is, the photo that Wendell has, I believe he took from the book by Amy Michel,
mm-hmm.
which was something that researchers, certainly did. They didn't have the internet back then. So if you were putting a slide presentation together, you wanted to have some nice UFO photos, you would often just take photos using slide film of photos out of a book. And then you could put work that into your slide presentation.
Yeah. Well, and I know one of the things that he did is he worked a lot with researchers where if someone wrote a book, because he liked to have as many photos as possible in his collection, he would get a hold of them and ask them if they could send him pictures so he could put them in his collection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
that would make sense.
I think, because like I said, and I can send this to you as well, you can see the side-by-side, it has the same contrast, it has the same photo blemish, which again is not the original 8x10 or the 8x10 copy that I have, but also the cropping of the photo is identical to the one Wendell has, whereas mine, you see much more of the cloud formations, which we'll talk about here in a little bit.
Well, it seems that Wendell was under the impression, though, that it was a Farmington picture, and you probably were able to discover more information about the 8x10 that you have. And was he accurate? Was it from that sighting?
Long story short, I'll answer the question and then I'll explain myself because I'm sure your audience is going to be like, why did he arrive at that conclusion? And this is going to be a very strange answer to your question. I believe, and this is after a lot of deliberation on my part in analyzing all of this information, I believe if, and I think this is important, if the photo is a true photo, it's not a hoax, if it is a legitimate photo of unidentified objects, I believe it is a photo of the objects that were seen over Farmington, but taken somewhere in the UK.
In the UK?
In the UK. And I know you and your listeners are probably thinking, what? what kind of answer is that? But if you'll permit me to explain, I'll kind of walk you through this. The 8x10 photo I have, it has a news teletype glued to the back, and I have many of these in my collection of 8x10 photos and news photos. Real quick, let me describe what's on the back of that. We have a news teletype that's glued onto the back. In addition to that, it also has a stamp, Keystone Press Agency Limited, Keystone House, Red Lion Court, Fleet Street, London, EC4, and then it has a phone number. And then handwritten on the bottom, it says GEN, which I believe just means general, flying saucers and UFOs, handwritten on the bottom. Now, the teletype is dated, and I'm looking at it here, I believe, let me just zoom in here, need my reading glasses to see this, March 25th, 1950. So, same month and same year as the Farmington sighting, but we're looking at about a week or so after the event, because again, we're looking at 15th, 16th, 17th. Mm-hmm. So roughly about 10 days after the sighting from Farmington, we have this news teletype. Now, the story is rather unusual that goes with the photo. It states on the news teletype, claimed to be the first sensational picture of the mysterious objects popularly known as flying saucers. This photograph is reproduced from this week's issue of the Teenage Times, a weekly newspaper published in Dublin. Then it states, the photograph, which shows five round-shaped objects in echelon formation through clouds, is accompanied by a news story, and then I won't read the whole thing, but it alludes to the fact that could these be a top-secret suspension bomb that could be held aloft to drop A-bombs and H-bombs on enemy targets. Purely speculative article. They don't reference any official informational sources to basically back up that theory.
Uh-huh.
But then it says at the end, according to the Teenage Times, the suspension bombs could already be swinging over several of the world's capital cities and even over some atomic energy installations. So this gave me a lead, obviously. The next step is, okay, let's research and find the original article published in the Teenage Times. Months went by, scouring the internet, making phone calls, sending email to people in Dublin, Ireland, trying to track down this Teenage Times. And for you or your listeners, if they go to the internet, type in Teenage Times, they'll find reference to this teletype and the photo. It's actually now, I believe, owned by Getty News Service, the image right. But you're only going to find one or two references to that, and that's it. no other references to this elusive newspaper called the Teenage Times.
Huh.
So after doing, and I literally had myself and several of my volunteers that helped me do UFO research here in Albuquerque, we were all running into brick walls. We could not find anything on this newspaper. I've never had such difficulty tracking down something as I have with this newspaper. But eventually, after going through newspaper archives online, doing random internet searches for every different type of word variable, Teenage Times, teen-age Times, going through just all different permutations, I finally decided I have a city, I have a country, Dublin, Ireland. I started going to individual library websites and trying to find to see if they had an online inventory of their what they have available on site. This search eventually led me to this beautiful facility. There's pictures on the internet, the National Library of Ireland, which is based in Dublin. And going through their inventory and doing search terms, they have the Teenage Times newspaper. Interestingly enough, the publication date only ran from 1949 to 1950. So based on limited information, the newspaper only ran for 1 year. Ironically enough, the last issue was the issue after the one that ran the photo, because it shows that their holdings only had the paper from November 4th, 1949 to April 1950. So as far as I can ascertain, the newspaper stopped production the following month after Farmington. But on the holdings, it lists format. Microfilm and digital formats were not available. All they had was copies of the original newspapers. So I went through the application process. I paid a nominal fee and had them take high-resolution pictures of the newspaper, specifically wanting the article with the photo so I could see the original newspaper that this story ran in that the news service alludes to. And after about a week or two or three, I finally received the newspaper. And the Teenage Times, the particular newspaper issue, was dated March 24th, 1950. They sent me the newspaper, and this is where you think you're going to get answers, and it just raises more questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've been in this position before doing investigations where you think you're going to get answers, and it's just led you down a whole other path of questioning.
Mm-hmm.
I received the scan, and I have this, and I can share this with you. I'm looking at the newspaper right now, and sure enough, it was the front page story, banner headline, "Suspension Bomb Threatens the World." That's the big front page news story.
Hmm.
And again, underneath that is the caption that read in the news teletype, "Here is the first sensational picture of the flying saucers, the mysterious objects which have mystified the world, and for which a possible explanation is given in our exclusive news feature." Unfortunately, nowhere near the photo or in the body of the article do they allude to who took the photo, where was it taken.
Mm-hmm.
I had the highest high when I finally realized I was going to be getting the original newspaper article, and then I hit the lowest low when I read the entire article, and there's no reference to the provenance of the photo.
Frustrating. And, you know, this is one of the better pictures that Wendell has, bigger pictures. Often in his in his records, he'll have a report that accompanies the photographs. And
yes.
In fact, in this particular binder with that photo, most of the photos have reports that go along with them. And in fact, if people read Open Minds magazine or look at our website, we would often post his photographs with the reports.
Absolutely.
And actually,
absolutely.
A lot of people ask, well, where are all the records? We have literally already posted every single report and photo from that we have found. So we've got them all either in the magazine or online.
Yeah.
But this one, well, I couldn't find a report, so I don't know, and he's passed away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, unfortunately, we lost him. You know, it was a big loss.
So we don't know why he thinks that photo came from Farmington or what evidence he may have. Oh, there's more to the story.
There's more, and this is you're going to scratch your head, and I can see your audience sitting there scratching their head as they're listening to this discussion. There was something wrong with the newspaper, and I couldn't put my finger on it at first. I'm looking at it, and mind you, I'm looking at the entire front page newspaper. I'm looking at the photo, and sure enough, there it is. You have these five prominent objects, and you have the clouds in the photo that you're familiar with. But there's a problem. The objects are in a different position in the sky relative to the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the news teletype ran the photo that we were all familiar with that you posted on OpenMind's website, and we're familiar with that. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that anyone has discovered this, but the photo that they say, this is the photo that ran the Teenage Times, was not the photo that ran in the Teenage Times. It's a similar photo, but in point of fact, apparently these two photos were in a series of photos that were taken. Mm-hmm. And I've done comparative analysis showing the cloud formations relative to the objects, and based on my analysis, the objects are in a formation that are moving in a uniform fashion, but when you do a side-by-side comparison of the photo in the newspaper and the photo that we're familiar with, they're actually moving to the left, assuming we're looking at it going from the right to the left, and moving slightly up. And you can see that there is, in fact, two photos. It was not just a singular photo. For the first time, we have evidence that whatever these photos, wherever they were taken, whoever took them, there were actually two photos, not just one.
Mm-hmm. Is there something more that leads you to believe that they were taken in the UK?
Yes. Well, I tie it to the UK mainly because the only news story I can find related to it is in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And the news service, if you recall, the stamp on my 8x10, the news service that attested ownership to that was based in Fleet Street in London.
Mm-hmm.
So we have London, we have Dublin, okay? And it also says on the back of the picture, please return Picture Library TV Times, which is a British news service at the time. So all the hallmarks are Ireland and England.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to something else. After I did a comparative analysis of the two photos, clearly showing that these are the same formation, and the photo was probably taken seconds apart. And you can see, because I actually do an analysis where I outline the cloud formations, the prominent clouds in the photo, and undoubtedly, when you do a side-by-side comparison, I'd be happy to send this to you, Alejandro, you can see the photo, the two photos side-by-side, and clearly it is the same cloud formations in both photos, yet you have this formation of circular objects that appear to be moving, again, assuming that it's an echelon formation, and they're moving from right to left. But again, after all of these years, since 1950, no one knew that there was a second photo.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time that we've uncovered this. So this is, you know, just one more piece of new information that's now come to light. Now, to answer your question, why do I tie it to the UK? Mainly because of those ownership titles on the paper, but also, again, over the last year and a half, going through newspaper archives, both in Europe, as well as, you know, specifically England, but also in the United States, looking through myriad of newspaper articles, typing in flying saucer photo, echelon formation, Farmington, New Mexico flying saucer photo, all the permutations you can imagine. I can't find any reference to this photo, and I searched from 1950 all the way to 1965. I can't find this photo anywhere else in any other newspaper articles.
Right. You know, when I tried to do research on it as well to find out why did Wendell think this was from Farmington, I couldn't find anything either. So
it's frustrating.
It is very frustrating, but it's fascinating that the picture is still from March 1950.
It is. I agree. And isn't it interesting because, as you mentioned, these are structured objects. And in 1950, the vast majority of UFO photos, which there weren't many in 1950, were of usually amorphous lights, you know, very, again, ambiguous lights in the sky. We very rarely have photos of structured objects, you know, one, let alone multiple structured objects in a photo. So really, this was a fascinating photo for the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the clincher for me was this. I really wanted to tie it to Farmington. I mean, how great, wouldn't that be great to tie it directly to the Farmington incident? But after focusing on the object and then looking at the cloud formations, something suddenly clicked. Now, keep in mind, I have all the newspaper accounts. I also have Dr. James McDonald's investigative notes, as well as some other investigator reports that James had in his files.
Mm-hmm.
I also have some of the weather reports. All indicators state that on March 17th, the big day, there was a light scattering of cirrus clouds at 20,000 feet, depending on where you were looking, or it was clear skies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but this is documented from 1950 that it was either clear skies or light scattering of cirrus clouds at 20,000 feet.
Yeah.
You look at the photos, if you do contrast enhancement or you do negative imagery of the photo, you look at those clouds, those are not cirrus clouds. They are some type of cumulus cloud formation.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
When I said, do I believe they're from Farmington? No. Not because of the objects, but the clouds in the photo. We have to look at the clouds as well as the objects themselves. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, though. Again, my cryptic answer to your question, do I think these are from Farmington? I don't think the photo was taken in Farmington, but I think they're photos of the objects that were seen in Farmington. Now, again, there were sightings in Mexico, Colorado, Texas of unidentified objects moving in formation quite often. But this is very interesting. And again, if your audience can reference the photo, the lead object, again, assuming it's in an echelon formation, the larger object in that photo, which is on the left side of the photo, is a circular object. But if you notice, there's a circular structure more towards the center of the object as well. And when you compare that photo to the description that this witness stated, and the witness was quoted as stating, and by the way, he was a naval veteran and private pilot, he said that the lead object was in the center of the formation, surrounded by silvery disks. But he went on to state that it was a perfect replica of a dinner plate, even to the bottom ring.
Hmm.
And if you look at that lead object in that famous photo, that certainly looks like a dinner plate with a raised ring on the bottom of the dinner plate. So isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So the description in Farmington matches characteristics that are in that photo. And keep in mind, I have other witness testimony that told me that they saw these objects moving in formation. And we have not one photo, but two photos now in the series showing that they did show movement from one position to another relative to the clouds. And I might add, when they moved, they maintained their position, their relative position to one another. So the characteristics that are exemplified in that photo, which, again, remember, was first published in 1950, a week or so, about 10 days after the Farmington sighting. So temporally, this photo did appear around the time of Farmington, but based on the clouds in the background of the photo, I think it was taken somewhere else. But the description sure sounds like what was described in Farmington.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really fascinating picture. Yeah, people will be able to find it. We did a YouTube video on it, so you could look at Google Farmington, or I mean look in the search on the openminds.tv. And yeah, we'll have it in the feature picture for when we post this, so people will be able to see the photo there. It'll be the photo that they'll be looking at when they are listening to the show. So and it's a really fascinating image, and it doesn't look completely really like balloons. I guess, it's just an interesting picture.
And what's interesting is not just the object in what apparently is the foreground, but you'll notice, and your listeners will notice, these smaller circular objects, which I've really analyzed. And by the way, if you don't mind me throwing this out there, I really would like to enlist the aid of a photographic expert to analyze the original 8x10 I have from 1950. And the reason I say that is if you look at these smaller objects in that photo, the definition is pretty clear that they're circular, dark objects. But what's extremely interesting, and to me adds credibility to the photo, is that you see smaller circular objects in the clouds and apparently moving through the clouds, but they are of a lighter density. In other words, the ones that are clearly defined that apparently must be higher altitude are clearly defined when they're not in the clouds, when they're in the clear portion of the sky. But you can see that the other ones are somewhat vague. They're somewhat faded as they're apparently moving through the clouds.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we're running out of time, but you did say, I mean, is this the, there were other photos?
No, just these two.
Okay.
Rather than one, we now have two photos, and I'd be happy to send you the Teenage Times article and the other photo if you'd want to, you know, be able to compare the two.
Yeah, I would love to take a look at that. That's really interesting. So what a great case.
Yes, and there's a lot more information. Obviously, too much to go into in the time we have, but hopefully we'll have more information that will come to light. I'll be lecturing on this in the month and in the next year to come.
Mm-hmm.
And very anxious to share this new material, a lot of new material within the James McDonald files, which have never been made public, specific to this case.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of information. Unlike a lot of cases, Alejandro, where we have a dearth of information to work with, in this case, there's an abundance of information, and it's just been a pleasure correlating that information and trying to make sense of this old case. And I feel that I've shed some new insights into it, and certainly hope that your listeners will find it fascinating as well.
Oh, I'm sure they will. In fact, like me, they're probably thinking, oh, I wish time wasn't up. We need another hour or two to talk about this. Because it's really fascinating. And yeah, that's what's great about these old cases, especially this one, in that there's this entire history with even living witnesses to
yes.
hear from. And
yes.
I guess my last question will be, I want to ask, did the witness give the impression that this had a big impact on the locals?
It did initially. But mm-hmm. as the one witness, the 91-year-old witness that I spoke with, because there's two living witnesses that I've interviewed, the one that I spoke with, he was interested at the time, but as he said, you know, the next day, he said, I had to go back to work. I couldn't stand up there gawking at the sky all day. And really, the people of Farmington, and I go up there on business on a frequent basis today, but the people then took it pretty much in stride. I mean, they had to go back the next day. They had to pay their taxes. Life goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really upset the population. It was a curiosity, and it was actually referenced a few times in the weeks following in the newspaper and so forth. A lot of letters were being written to the Farmington Times requesting more information. But, no, people took it in stride. No one panicked. I think that's an important part to emphasize. And, you know, but it was interesting because I presented all this new data that I've gathered. I actually went through my entire hour and a half presentation with this witness. And as I was presenting it, I could see wheels turning, and he kept kind of rubbing his brow. And afterwards, he told me, and I took this as one of the highest compliments coming from one of the last living witnesses to the event. He said, you know, I really hadn't given it that much thought after the incident occurred. Life went on. But he goes, you have shed so much new information on this case. He said, you've really got me thinking. He goes, I had no idea that there was other things going on at the time beyond Farmington. And he said, the way that you put all this information together, he goes, after all these decades, you've got me rethinking this whole thing now.
Yeah.
And to me, that's one of the highest compliments that you could be paid is, you know, from an actual eyewitness that after, you know, 60-plus years, decided just to kind of move on and forget about it. But after all these decades, he's really intrigued now, and he's really trying to, you know, process all the information that I've put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe there are more witnesses out there that feel the same, and I'm sure not just more locals, but other investigators, because this is some really – I think this is some great history that, you know, encompasses a lot of the important history when it comes to this topic, in that it was a grudge report, Lincoln La Paz's comments, really cool stuff. Well, thank you so much for doing the research, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with
thank
us.
Thank you, Alejandro. I appreciate it. Absolutely. I appreciate it. And mm-hmm. I finally have a website, if I can just mention that to the audience.
Please do. That's what I was going to ask.
I've been asked to get a website for the last 2 or 3 years, and I finally have it. It's in its infancy, so bear with me. But for anybody interested in contacting me, my website is davidmarlerufo.com.
davidmarlerufo.com. Great. And they can probably find out more about your Triangle UFO book as well.
Yes. yes. And hopefully in investigating the Farmington incident, I'll break the stereotype because a lot of people think all I do is investigate triangles. But I have a vast library, and I'm interested in the subject matter as a whole. So, you know, hopefully in investigating Farmington, I won't get stereotyped as the triangle guy, as people have alluded to me.
Well, that's not a bad stereotype because triangles are real popular. It's an important part of all of this, and you've done really important, work. So people are excited about your work in triangles. But now, yeah, you'll be able to expand as the true magnificent UFO researcher that you are.
Well, I appreciate you allowing me to share my information with your audience.
Yeah, more than happy to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alejandro.
Thank you so much to David Marler for joining us today on the show. Pretty exciting because, this last week, I don't remember what it was, a story in the news or something about the Farmington case. And a lot of people were really excited that David Marler was going to talk about that case with us on the show, and it's well worth it. I think we could have talked about this case for hours, and not just because it's an amazing case, but all of the amazing research that David has done. So it's amazing that he does what he does, and he does it the right way. And as you can tell from listening to him, he really delves into get the details. And that's awesome because things like that photograph, certainly when we talk about it here at Open Minds, we want to be accurate as to, what the photograph is portraying and who it comes from and where and why and what and when. Although we don't have all the answers yet, David is on the case. So thank you to David for coming and joining us on the show. You can find him at davidmarlerufo.com. Very cool website. And it's got a lot about what he's been up to. And I'm sure you could keep up to speed there to find out when this new book happens. And, of course, we'll keep you up to date as well. And we'll have him back if that book does come into – if or when – that book does come into fruition. But thank you all for joining us. Thank, of course, Martin Willis for joining us with the news from Podcast UFO. A great fella. We'll have him back again soon. Well, assuming we have a show next week with the holidays, you never know. This show, of course, being late and stuff just gets so crazy this time of year. One of the things that we're really crazy with is the UFO Congress, of course, which is coming up in February. A lot of fun. So I said it on the show last week, but I haven't really gotten it up on the website, that our surprise guest is Doug Trumbull, a special effects guru, superstar, legend in Hollywood for the technology he utilizes in film. He does the biggest, best, highest deaf ever, so he's known for that, and he also has done special effects for the best movies ever, and he's doing UFO Talk, a UFO project that we talk about often. So he'll be appearing with his buddy Don, or Mark D'Antonio, and of course we have Jacques Vallée with Lee Spiegel. And you know what, I'm going to read down a more comprehensive list for you all, because we do have a lot of exciting speakers. We have David Jacobs, we have David Hatcher Childress, how awesome. If you're into ancient aliens, he's a great speaker. He just goes like slide after slide with really incredible stuff. We have Chase Kletsky, who is a great UFO researcher who has been getting a lot of attention lately. She went to Australia, and you would think that she was could walk on water or something. They really liked her there, and she got a lot of publicity, which is cool. And, of course, if you heard our radio show, our podcast with her last year, you would understand why that is. She's a lot of fun, and so we're really excited about that. But John Greenwald, Barbara Lamb, Paul David, he's great. He's a filmmaker. And speaking of filmmakers, actually, this is really exciting because I just got done talking with Keith Arum, who, of course, we had on the show just a couple months ago, and he has his movie, The Phoenix Incident, coming out, and it will be premiering. In fact, you're going to be able to see it at the UFO Congress a couple months before it hits theaters. And you'll get to meet the filmmaker. He wrote it. He directed it, and it's all about the Phoenix Lights. And warning, spoiler alert, at least not a movie spoiler alert, a online internet spoiler alert. As he told us, they are running a virus campaign, and the code is disclose now. But when you see that tag, be careful. Most likely, that is viral campaigning for his movie, The Phoenix Incident. So I know they were supposed to launch their viral campaign earlier. They are actually launching it as we speak. It's ramping up. So there's stuff out there, some really fun stuff. But don't be mistaken that, you know, this is some real stuff. But it's take a look and follow what they're doing with the film. He does this kind of movie interactive stuff, and he's going to be doing more of it, and he's got some really exciting projects. But this is going to be like the first online interactive movie, this Phoenix Incident. If you want to know more about what we mean by that, come to the Congress, and you can ask Keith about it yourself, but you'll also know more as time goes on, because, of course, you all are my friends, and I like to notify you of the latest and the greatest as soon as I know about it. So exciting stuff. I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas. I hope you have an excellent New Year. If you want some great music to party with, you can go to the Clerk Chronicles. That is the website of Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music. I want to thank him for doing that opening and close music. It's awesome stuff. So go check his stuff out. Go download it for free and then rock out this New Year's with it. But you all have a wonderful New Year's Eve. Have a wonderful and safe New Year's. And I guess I can tell you safely now, I'll talk to you next year. Adios, muchachos.